and a cost savings. It reduces the amount of stormwater that must be transported and treated at facilities that are owned and operated by the city. Reducing the amount of stormwater flowing through the stormwater system could extend the life of this expensive infrastructure, meeting multiple policy objectives and compliance obligations, federal, state, regional, and local, through one set of actions can result in a net benefit to the city and its utility ratepayers. Treating stormwater on-site where appropriate and within the watershed where it falls allows for groundwater recharge. This can have a positive environmental effect when groundwater is a source or contributes to surface water runoff. The PERB further recommends that monitoring analysis of future projects, including the proposed Burnside and Coot Street project, be conducted to better understand cost savings in construction and maintenance, sediments in soil and water, quality and volume control, tracking problems associated with particular Green Street design features. Sorry to run over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Brian Wagoner. I'm the Watershed Watch Coordinator for Tualatin Riverkeepers. Our office is in Tigard. And I wanted to come here and give you the view from the suburbs. First of all, we're very appreciative of the leadership that Portland has shown on this issue. Commissioner Adams, your command of the and knowledge of the issues here and the benefits of low-impact development and your eloquent talk of this is leadership that we don't see in too many elected officials, so we are very appreciative of that. And we see that carrying down to your staff. The cross-bureau communication involved in this project is what's going to make it a success. We know if we manage for just one objective, we're going to have unintended consequences. But by involving multiple bureaus in developing this plan, you have avoided those problems and actually increased the benefits. I'd like to talk about the ripple effect of Portland's leadership on low-impact development and green streets. The first effect that we're seeing is in my hometown of Tigard. Tigard has now committed to making green streets a key feature of their downtown redevelopment project. We think Portland's leadership had a lot to do with that. And of all the benefits that we've heard today about green streets, one of the ones that has not been mentioned is that it is an engine for economic development. We see Portland's leadership is changing the economy and growing local industry by doing this. One example is Tufel Nursery, one of the large nurseries in the area. They have a separate division that specializes in plants just for eco roofs, green roofs. We see Portland landscape architecture firms like Greenworks getting awards and attention and customers from outside the region because of the expertise they have developed here. We see suppliers like Glacier Northwest increasing their product line to include pervious pavement, and Mutual Materials changing their product mix that they sell to local retailers to include pervious pavers. When I was an employee at Pacific Corp years ago, one of our executives gave a speech to the employees about leadership in adopting new technology, and he said Pacific Corp wants to be the first to be second. Portland has stuck his neck out and taken risks to be a leader in this. And because of that leadership, we're hoping that the cities of Washington County are going to line up to be the first to be second in adopting what you are adopting today. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Tom Putman, citizen of Portland, civil engineer and consultant with David Evans and Associates. I come as a representative of the City of Portland Stormwater Advisory Committee, and we're submitting a letter to the commission, which you've just received. I'd like to read that letter. On behalf of the City of Portland Stormwater Advisory Committee, we are writing in support of the proposed Green Streets Policy and Green Streets Cross Bureau Phase 2 report. The Stormwater Advisory Committee has worked for many years to identify and promote measures that will improve stormwater management of the city's transportation system. Recognizing that this city's streets are a significant contributor of urban runoff and pollution, the Stormwater Advisory Committee presented its stormwater management recommendations for transportation-related development to the City Council in 2004. That report strongly urged expanded implementation of Green Street approaches as a cost-effective way to reduce runoff and pollution. The Stormwater Advisory Committee also provided input to both Phase 1 and Phase 2 work of the Green Streets Cross Bureau team. The Phase 2 report and policy reflect a number of elements that are very important to, to both effective stormwater management and Portland's overall commitment to sustainable practices. A multi-bureau cooperative effort, a watershed context, and an integration of multiple city goals such as neighborhood livability, improved urban habitat, and connectivity. Incorporation of the Green Streets policy into the city's comprehensive plan, transportation system plan, and city system plan is also essential to ensure the green streets are an integral consideration in all city programs. We strongly support making the policy binding and urge the city pursue funding sources that initiate, encourage, implement, and maintain green street projects throughout the city. We are encouraged to see the city's commitment to improve stormwater management and watershed health and urge City Council to accept and endorse the Phase 2 report and policy. On behalf of the City of Portland Stormwater Advisory Committee and its co-chairs, I thank you. And now that I've got a couple seconds left, I personally would like to thank the Commission and the work of Linda Dobson and her work over the last 4 or 5 years on this, and PDOT and BES. It's over the last decade, it's been tremendous growth to see this move from just test pilot projects into potential city policy. I thank you.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks for your service, and convey to the Stormwater Advisory Committee their thanks. My thanks as well.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Our last person is Brent Vandenhoevel. Brett.
Thank you, members of the commission. My name is Brett Vandenhoevel. I'm with Columbia Riverkeeper. And we wanted to thank the City of Portland for their efforts in stormwater management. We encourage the city to expand the Green Street program, pursue other innovative technology to manage stormwater. As you know, stormwater is a major source of water quality degradation. In fact, EPA has recently stated that is the major source of water quality problems in the United States today. Columbia Riverkeeper is involved in a lawsuit regarding stormwater permits with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, including the City of Portland's permit and several other municipalities. We don't think the Oregon DEQ is leading in the difficult issue of stormwater. However, we think the City of Portland can fill this void and is filling this void to a certain extent. Portland is the leader right now in Green Street technology, is the leader in stormwater management, and we want to just thank the city for their continued effort this and really encourage the city to continue to expand this for water quality problems. Portland is one of the few cities that has the political will and has the community support to become the leader on this. The key now is to implement all of the research we've done. We recognize the costs of green streets, but as you know, I mean, it's been said 100 times that the long-term economic benefits far outweigh the cost of investing in this now. We recognize there's going to be continued cost of green streets, but always keep in mind the cost of treating it at the treatment plants and the cost of water quality degradation to our rivers. The water quality benefits of treating stormwater at its source or preventing stormwater are tremendous. It just makes sense to stop this polluted water from reaching our treatment plants and reaching our rivers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's all who signed up.
I had a question for the staff. It has to do with the Green Street Fund. And there's reference in there to offsite management fees. Could you explain those two issues, both where the Green Street Fund would be cited, and that does private development projects, are they included in this and when it's in the right of way?
I'll take that one.
Right.
That's our phase three, is the private development projects. We wanted to sort of get this done, booked, and then we will pursue that from here. So I hope to come back to you within the next 6 months with that piece.
That's the 1% for green,
yep,
right.
Fund is right now proposed to be just public agencies that do work in the right-of-way that do not otherwise trigger the stormwater manual. The stormwater manual, of course, does apply to private development. And I should add, you know, we've talked a lot about Green Street features and all today, about the Bureau and PDOT's efforts in this area. I should mention that the work that we're doing and the trail that we're blazing is leading a lot of the private developers in this direction too. So a lot of the projects you'll see around the city are being done by private development, which is very encouraging to us, of course. Sorry, Mayor, I forgot the other part of your question.
It was the off-site management fee and then the Green Street Fund as to how that would work.
Okay. Do you want me to talk about that? The Green Street Fund, this 1% fund, would be money that we would then spend in the Bureau to either, for instance, contribute if PDOT was doing a project and they needed a little extra money to actually make it greener, we would potentially contribute to some of those efforts. There might be projects that we, the Bureau, would do, some of our stormwater projects associated with school property and so forth, we fund out of ratepayers' money. So that's how the Green Fund would be used. The in lieu of fee is a fee that's currently part of the stormwater manual that if someone is proposing to do development that triggers the manual and they can demonstrate to us that they have no feasible method of handling their stormwater on site. It might be a steep slope. It might be clay soils. It might be a tight property line situation that they just can't. So they go through that hierarchy. They can't meet those on-site treatments. Then they have the option of paying into this in lieu of fund. And then the Bureau invests that money to help solve these problems off-site.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you.
Please call the vote.
Adams?
Well, there are three bureaus that are responsible for the right-of-way in the city of Portland, the Office of Transportation, the Bureau of Environmental Services, and the Bureau of Water Works. And someone who has been behind the scenes incredibly supportive on this issue has been Commissioner Randy Leonard. And so in closing, I wanted to thank you for your willingness to support this. I think it's very complimentary to all the work that you're doing in other areas of biofuels and hydro parks, helping to green the city and keep the air clean. So I want to thank you. Also want an opportunity to introduce to the audience Lisa Libby. Raise your hand. She's the new senior policy director in my office for issues related to the environment and our utilities. So welcome aboard. And with that, I'll just vote aye.
Leonard?
I am very pleased with this effort. In fact, at the first hydro park in East Portland, we have a green street growing in that we've done in cooperation with BES, and it is a very cool amenity to the neighborhood. The neighborhood just loves it. So thanks for all this good work, Guy.
Saltzman.
Well, this is great work. I want to commend all the bureaus, Commissioner Adams, for really taking this from the R&D stage to sort of an accelerated implementation. I think Bob Salinger's comments were particularly apropos that you can only R&D something so much. You need to gain more experience from having more real-world examples, and this is going to take it to that next plateau. And it's going to have substantial impacts, benefits for our environment, for our water quality, and our livability. So it's great work, and I'm really pleased to support this. Aye.
Sten.
Well, I agree. This is very exciting, and I think it's really we needed to get a couple of these types of major innovations really pushing harder to kind of get ourselves to the next level on all the issues. I mean, I think we've been out in front of green strategies, and at the same time, if you look at the sum total of our very impressive reductions in emissions, greenhouse gas, and pollutants and other pieces, we're still short of changing the fundamental trends. And at the end of the day, if we do a lot but don't change the fundamental trends, we have failed. And I think trying to take the street issue head on like you are in this case could get us there on a couple of key indicators. And so I'm very excited about this and prepared to make any votes that Commissioner Adams and the team brings forward to try and get the implementation in place. And I also think that as a gentleman from Evans and Associates said, you know, I think this is also another place where the primary motivation needs to be environmental, but there's an economic piece here that if we can put this technology together, there actually literally isn't a city in the world that couldn't potentially benefit from it, and we ought to be doing some work with PDC and the Office of Sustainable Development to think about how to market the expertise of Evans and Associates and the folks who are going to build these and tend to them, because I also think that we need to look at ways to export our work to bring in dollars to employ our citizens, and I think this is one where if we continue to be out ahead, we might have that added benefit as well. So terrific work, and I love walking by these as well, and look forward to seeing more of them. Aye.
Potter.
I think this is a very effective way to deal with our wastewater management, but it also embraces a number of other values and policies that the city has. I'm really pleased to see the bureaus working hand in glove on this issue. And I think that 20 years from now, Portland will look different as a result of these activities. So I want to thank everybody that's been involved in this. Thank you. Aye. Please read the 10-15 time certain.
Item 394, creation of the Quality Rental Housing Work Group.
Sure. I think we had a short presentation that was going to come forward, and this is a project I've been working closely with Commissioner Leonard on, and we're essentially creating a quality rental housing work group, and the idea is to focus in on what are the most effective strategies to help tenants out there make sure that their rentals are up to par. And we've done different strategies in the past, and the rental market has changed a lot, and so we want to take another look. There's some serious health issues we've seen, ranging from mold and other things to just a series of also trying to figure out how best to work with the industry. You know, there's been policy. There's been years and years ago there were proposals to license all landlords and sort of a sense that at some point said it, maybe that's too much for landlords that are doing the right thing and we need to focus on those who are not. And so we're going to take a look at all these issues with a fresh eye and try and come back with some solid recommendations to the council. So let me turn this introduction over to Commissioner Leonard, who I appreciate his and I should also say, as I appreciate Commissioner Leonard's helping me with this, that it should be also very clear that Commissioner Leonard has not waited for the creation of any group to go out and go after some landlords who are doing the wrong thing as well. So this is not a delayed action, but more institutionalizing some actions with this work group.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments very much. And, of course, we have the point person here that helps me do that, Ed Maryhart, who is in charge of the inspectors that actually go out and make sure housing is safe and clean and habitable. And it is, honestly, amongst the most challenging jobs in the city, including police and fire work. It is really tough to find that balance between making sure housing is acceptable even for people who are really struggling to survive and have that done without losing the housing. It's really a difficult balance, as Commissioner Sten knows, and helping me with a lot of these things is just really a testament to the housing folks' really good work. So I appreciate all the work you guys are doing. Thanks. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mayor Potter, members of the council. We really appreciate both the support that you've given both the Bureau of Housing and Community Development as well as the Bureau of Development Services in working on this issue. We also appreciate the grasp that you have on the delicate balance that this issue entails in terms of retaining the affordable housing stock for Portland's most vulnerable populations while at the same time ensuring that that housing stock is of good quality and not substandard. So we're here today to talk about the Quality Rental Housing Work Group that BHCD is working on convening. As you probably have seen from recent media coverage, both Channel 2 and in the Tribune on mold and mildew and some of our affordable housing complexes here locally, it's becoming more commonly accepted that housing is an important determinant of health and safety of its occupants. We know that issues of habitability and housing condition are directly connected to issues of poor health, including lead poisoning in young children, increased rates of asthma exacerbated by poor indoor air quality, incidence of respiratory infection as a result of mold and mildew, even injury. And the City of Portland, through the Bureau of Development Services Neighborhood Inspection Program, does have a role in ensuring that rental property owners are providing housing in accordance with property maintenance regulations under Title 29. This code language exists largely, as Ed will go into further detail on, to protect the health and safety of occupants, but local data, some grounded in numbers, some grounded in anecdotal evidence, tells us that there are potential improvements that can be made to this complaint-driven program to increase its ability to ensure that renters are living in units that are in compliance with the city's housing maintenance requirements. The 2002 American Community Survey of the U.S. Census found that 7,000 households living in Portland had units with multiple or repeated problems with heating, plumbing, or electrical systems, with approximately 97 or so rental units. That's 7% of renters that are living in units that are either substandard or in poor condition. The Multnomah County Office of Legal Aid estimates that it receives an average of 600 calls per year. That's approximately 65% of all of their calls from low-income tenants with habitability concerns or that are seeking repairs to their unit. And then lastly, just to touch on a piece of information from Ed's program, in 2005, the Neighborhood Inspection Program opened approximately 1,500 housing cases due to violations of the Property Maintenance Code, Title 29. Just giving you a sense of 1,500 households utilized the complaint-driven system. So we are left wondering how many households did not utilize that complaint-driven system for fears of retaliation from their property owner, their landlord. And on average, 50% of housing cases remain open up to 6 months later with unresolved code violations. So then again, that's up to 6 months where low income, well, actually, we're not sure that those households are indeed low income, but that 50% of those cases are remaining open with repairs that are not made and households are being left with issues that may impact their health. So just a little bit about the Bureau of Housing and Community Development's role on this issue. This is one that we have not been involved in. We've been watching for several years. During that time, with the council's generous support, we have been able to provide relocation assistance to rental households living in substandard housing. So when a rental household is living in a unit that's received a vacate order for issues identified from the Neighborhood Inspections Program, the Bureau of Housing and Community Development is able to go in with some relocation assistance so that they are then relocated to another unit. However, in recent years, demand for these services has increased, and we now believe that it's time for a more systemic approach to addressing the problem of substandard housing rather than just addressing one of its symptoms, which is the potential displacement of low-income families and children. I wanted to highlight a couple of the processes that also have led BHCD to the point of realizing it's time to convene a working group to look at these issues. The Community Alliance of Tenants recently completed a report. Actually, it was about a year ago. I think that staff in your office received a copy of the report and had the opportunity to talk to the Community Alliance of Tenants about it. They interviewed 65 low-income renters, who 50% of whom said that they had issues with substandard housing and an inability to get repairs made upon request. Additionally, there was some indication that these households were also afraid of retaliation from their landlord in terms of utilizing the existing complaint-driven neighborhood inspection program. BHCD is required to complete a HUD-mandated document called the Analysis of Impediments to Fair Housing. This comprehensive report looks at just exactly what it says it looks at, impediments to fair housing, and that report also indicated that housing quality was a significant barrier to housing choice for low-income households in Portland. And then lastly, you know, probably a couple times a year, there's media coverage on substandard housing issues, habitability issues, mold, mildew primarily, sometimes lead-based paint, on a larger scale in affordable housing complexes in Portland, most recently, again, by the Tribune and Channel 2 News. And so then bringing this back to the Quality Rental Housing Work Group, what we envision is that BHCD will initiate a collaborative review of the issue that crosses both bureaus, BHCD as well as BDS, and jurisdictions, City of Portland and Multnomah County. The Multnomah County Health Department has been a vital partner in this initiative. We would like to examine more closely the reported incidences of substandard housing in Portland, examine the efficacy of existing programs in achieving compliance with Title 29, as well as create an effective toolbox, make sure that we have that effective toolbox at our fingertips to increase the ability of the city to effectively enforce the housing maintenance code and provide resources to tenants to secure repairs without the fear of landlord retaliation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ed Merrihart, who manages the Neighborhood Inspections Program for BDS.
Good morning. Thank you, Andrea. Again, Ed Merrihart. I'm the program manager or the manager of the Neighborhood Inspections Team at BDS, and we recently went back to BDS from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. First of all, I just wanted to reemphasize the mission and purpose of the Neighborhood Inspection Team in Title 29, the City's Property Maintenance Code. Its mission and purpose is to establish minimum standards for property maintenance, which is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, prevent deterioration of existing housing, and also to contribute to neighborhood livability. As Andrea mentioned, over the last couple of years, we've been an integral partner in working in conjunction with the Community Alliance of Tenants on their Safe Housing Project. Over the last couple of years, we've worked with and participated with the Multnomah County Homes Healthy Initiative Grant and the County PACE Grant Project, which stands for Protocols for Assessing Community Excellence in Environmental Health, which looked and identified at health-related environmental hazards, for example, mold, moisture, water leakage, lead paint, garbage, vermins, and its impact on housing. We have also been working in partnership with the BHCD on issues relating to the safety and habitability of affordable rental housing and also preserving of existing housing for vulnerable populations, low-income owner-occupied, and also tenant relocation assistance for low-income renters. Sometimes a property is so bad that we have to go to the code hearings officer and request a vacate order because of the conditions, serious fire life safety issues. And if we do get a vacate order from the code hearings officer, if the tenant is low income, they can access the tenant relocation assistance program that BHCD funds. Again, it was mentioned that neighborhood inspection is a complaint-driven system, and we know that only a small percentage of the rental households with habitability and substandard housing issues are actually being inspected. Again, Andrea mentioned that we receive approximately 1,500 housing complaints a year that we actually go out and inspect. And again, the average housing case is open 5 to 6 months before all violations are corrected. And currently we have outstanding revolving liens of approximately $5 to $5.25 million. And just to give some background, the current funding of the Neighborhood Inspections Program is approximately 80% from program revenues, fees, and approximately 20% from general fund. And we have a council directive to continue as much as possible minimal impact on general fund funding, which means greater impact on fees, et cetera, for properties that are in violation of Title 29. Again, I want to lend my support to the resolution and the work group. We view ourselves as an integral part since we are the enforcement arm for the city for affordable, sustainable housing. And we view this as an opportunity for the group to look at the Neighborhood Inspections Enforcement Program comprehensively for possible improvements, maybe different approaches, possible code changes, increasing our toolbox that we have, better maintenance standards for indoor environmental health hazards, fees and funding issues, timelines for making repairs, and possible additional collection mechanisms of fees, and also additional improved landlord and tenant education programs. Bottom line is we welcome the group looking at the current enforcement system and seeing if it can be beefed up or to further affect the maintenance of quality rental housing or if we need to come up with a new, different system. And also, I think we look forward to relooking at some of the recommendations that I think Commissioner Stinn had alluded to from the 1992 Citizens Advisory Committee on Quality Rental Housing that were not adopted. Some of them were not adopted back in 1992, but we welcome relooking at some of those to see if they are more appropriate and should be adopted, you know, currently. And that's all that I have to say. And then I'd also like to mention that there are several community members here that wish to testify in support of the resolution.
Thank you.
I have a question, actually. So the issue of mold seems to have become a lot more serious in, well, since 1992. I think we know a lot more about mold issues and its impacts on health. I've talked to some people in the Sustainable Development Office who are pretty knowledgeable in mold issues. They talk about a lot of mold is due to inadequate ventilation, either in bathrooms or kitchens in particular. Do we have mechanisms in place, or is this something that we would look at in terms of developing new code that would address, I guess, retroactively, issues of inadequate ventilation in kitchens and bathrooms?
We currently have the current Title 29 does deal with moisture and mold issues, maybe not quite as comprehensively or as it could. But, for example, it does deal with required ventilation. Oftentimes when we go out to mold or we get mold complaints, sometimes it's a combination of structural issues like lack of ventilation. It can also be sometimes tenant habits, having too much stuff, not keeping or not turning the fans on, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of times it's a two-way street, tenant education. And then also when we go out and inspect on mold and moisture complaints, we take out moisture meters now, which we hadn't done. We've been recently doing that. BACD helped provide some money for us to purchase those and to try to find the moisture source. So that's our key thing, is looking for the moisture source to correct that.
So through Title 29, then, we have the ability, if ventilation is found to be inadequate or not maintained properly,
yes,
to require the landlords to either replace it or improve it.
Yes, but again, in conjunction with, if we can't require them to put a fan in, if they have, for example, in the bathroom, if they have a window that opens, mm-hmm. we want to make sure that the window is openable and can be used and can stay open. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we can't force the landlord to require the tenant to open that window when they're using the bathroom or the shower. But we can't require them to upgrade to put a fan in mm-hmm. if it wasn't in there originally. If the fan is not working, we can require them to maintain that fan and make it working.
And then the other issue that I think was played up in the TV coverage was the issue of simply being able to spray paint over mold and avoid any subsequent consequences.
Our practice is if we find mold on walls, et cetera, they have to have the mold removed with bleach. And if they do want to repaint it, that's fine. We suggest that they use amildicide in the paint. So we do require them to remove the mold.
And how do you know, I guess, if you come back in and whether it's been spray painted or bleached? I mean, how do you know that?
Well, we can tell if it's been that's a good question. When we go back in, if we don't see the mold and we see that it's been cleaned off, etc., we can tell it hasn't been painted. If we see it's been cleaned off with bleach and stuff, then that's okay. If it's been repainted, that's another issue. I mean, we talk to the tenants to see if they, collaborate what the landlord is saying, that, the mold was removed first and that mildicide was used in the paint. That gets a little tricky.
I mean, so if a landlord can demonstrate the mildicide was used in the paint, that's kind of a form of proof.
Correct.
But absent that, you're saying there's really no, you can't go and take a paint sample and put it under a microscope or whatever.
We really can't and don't do that. And that's something I think that the group as a whole is going to be looking at some better standards for us to be able to go out and decide, if the mold has been actually remediated or not.
Okay, so that's something, I think that's very important that we have an ability to independently verify that mold has been removed.
And right.
I don't know if putting it under a microscope or whether there's some other test. I just don't know anything about that, but it seems like there has to be a way to do that, and I hope that's going to be something that will come forward in your recommendations, because it's certainly something that I strongly support.
We anticipate that mold will receive quite a bit of attention from the work group on many levels.
Right, but it's you got to push beyond some of these issues of simply not knowing whether it's been remediated or not.
Right, and
have a way to really verify.
There are a number of housing advocates that are quite on top of the mold and mildew issues that have ensured us they will push us to explore all of these issues that you just brought up, particularly in great detail. So,
Is there a legislative side to this? It seems like with the folks we have in Salem now and on a federal level, that there may be some opportunities to introduce legislation to begin to control some of these particulates and mold that are in rental housing. I know that it's a significant contributor to children missing school and the development of asthma. So there's a lot of things that I think that we could work with. But is there any legislative agenda as part of this?
There is not a specific legislative agenda that's been detailed yet. We haven't ruled out creating a legislative agenda. Mold, mildew, lead are all regulated on some level at the federal level. Landlord-tenant law doesn't speak in language that is specific and detailed enough necessarily to allow tenants to easily use it to create change or to have issues addressed in their own unit. There is a statewide landlord-tenant group that has, I believe, if not talked about these issues, has decided not to talk about these issues at various points in the past simply because they are complex and it is difficult to come to consensus on them. Scientific data is also not as strong as it could be in terms of how to remediate mold, which mold is actually hazardous to children, those sorts of things. And so back to your original question, we haven't ruled out creating a legislative agenda at the state level now.
I should, just on a point of order, I'm going to have to leave at 11:30. So I don't know if we have emergency votes that we should
do. We do. We have three of them. Okay. But is there any testimony sign-up sheet on this?
We've got 11 people signed. I'm sorry, 9 people signed up.
I think, Commissioner Stan, were you going to go at the same time? Or?
I was, but
well, we also have folks going to a VRO lunch, so it would be nice to be able to move through this and get to some, at least the emergencies.
Yeah. And could we consider setting over the balance to tomorrow's Thursday if we get through this and the emergencies?
Set over the emergency?
No, if we get through the emergencies, can we set over the balance? And of the nine folks talking, we're really short on time, so if you could not repeat one another and be really to the point, we'd appreciate it.
Could you call the first three people?
Okay, the first three are Deborah Imse, IMSE, Aaron Bong, and Lila Weedrum. They'll be followed by Mickey Ryan, Ian Slingerland, and Jonathan Trouse.
Thanks for being here. Folks, when you speak, please state your name for the record, and you each have 2 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Imse, and I'm here representing Metro Multifamily Housing Association. Safe, affordable housing is an important part of the association's goals, and it's something that its members are very committed to. We are proud to provide over 100,000 safe, affordable units in the Portland metro area, as well as throughout the state of Oregon. And while the vast majority of affordable housing providers offer a clean and safe environment to their tenants, some may fall short of what is acceptable. It's important that the study pinpoint verified problems, focus solutions where the problems actually are, and make the enforcement fair and effective. Having said that, let me assure you that our association's members believe that bad actors should receive firm and swift results when it's been proven. I want to thank Commissioner Sten and Leonard's staff for considering our input in the resolution, and we look very much forward to working with you on this important study group.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Lila Wickham, and I'm the Director of Environmental Health for Multnomah County Health Department, and I am here to support the Quality Rental Housing Work Group because I believe it will convene people with housing and health expertise, and we will create better solutions. Just to for a brief background on public health and why it would be involved in housing, some of our core principles are about focusing on the health of the population as opposed to individuals, overcoming health disparities, and supporting policy decisions that are based in science and community-driven. So hence, we would be obviously involved in something as critical as housing. As Andrea mentioned, in 2002, Multnomah County put together a community engagement process to identify what are the environmental health concerns from the community. The affordable housing community came forward as a result of that engagement process, and our work with the affordable housing community identified mold and mildew, trash, lead, and an overarching feeling of being ignored as their primary issues and concerns. As a result of those findings, the health department put together a housing and urban development grant to work with low-income families of children with asthma to identify how we could support those families to overcome the asthma triggers, some of which are behavioral and some of which are housing-related. And it is our hope that those findings will support some of the policy recommendations that will come out of the work group. On May 17th, we're convening a housing summit to bring together the diverse partners who can support recommendations about health and housing.
My name is Aaron Bong. I'm here to talk about indefensible rights of tenants. I was here a year and 4 months ago to talk to you gentlemen about changes in Title 29 because my landlord was turning off the heat at night. And thankfully, all five of you voted to pass a resolution that required him to keep the heat on at night, which made our 47-degree temperature apartment go up to 68 degrees. The changes were made and announcements were carried by radio, newspaper, and television, and that's an important thing to remember. The heat was restored for a small amount of time, and then he started turning it off again. I made phone calls to the Bureau of Neighborhood Inspections, I believe under Commissioner Leonard, and was told point blank that if it didn't happen Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 when an inspector was there, it didn't happen. Kind of frustrating. 4 months and 7 days after I was here in front of you and requested a change in city code, I received a 30-day no-cause eviction for asserting my rights and standing in front of you and asking for a change. I was told by the manager to my face that he would not tolerate troublemakers in his apartment complex. This is Michael McNeil acting as an agent of Norris and Stevens telling me this. I contacted Norris and Stevens and left messages with the overseer of residential properties, Michael Henniger, who refused my phone calls and sent me straight to voicemail from his secretary. He was aware of the situation. He had been in my apartment when other repairs were made after the changes occurred in the code. During the time after receiving a 30-day notice, I diligently sought out alternate places of living. Finally, on the 19th of May, more than 20 days after issuing a 30-day notice, I received a letter in the mail with one line in it: disregard the 30-day notice. He had received enough information to realize that what was happening was illegal and was immoral and shouldn't be happening. I should not be evicted for asserting my rights. My 2 minutes are up, and I'm sorry, but this is something that has to happen. We need a committee. We need to be indefensible rights or rights that do not exist, and that's the state of tenant law right now. Tenants do not have an opportunity to defend themselves. I was told by six attorney firms that I did not have a case, even though Mr. Neves from KGW informed my manager, microphone in hand and cameraman with him, who it was that changed the code and that the code had been changed. Gentlemen, I don't have any rights as a tenant. Not the way that they stand now. Thank you for your time. Thank
you. Next three are Mickey Ryan, Ian Slingerland, and Jonathan Trouse.
Good Good morning.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Mickey Ryan. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center, and I represent low-income tenants in housing matters. I also served on the committee that reviewed the analysis of impediments recently. It's very important that the committee support the work of this committee, the council support the work of this committee. This work is critical to the future of Portland. I was on the committee that Ed referred to 15 years ago when it became clear that our housing stock was deteriorating and that big changes were happening in housing in Portland and that we needed a better system. And that committee took some small steps to fix the system, and thanks to the housing inspection team and Community Alliance of Tenants, we've had other improvements. The fine system that Ed referred to, that we now have a lot of liens on apparently, when the landlords don't comply with the city's orders. There's more work to do. You've heard the statistics that come out of the legal aid offices and Community Alliance of Tenants. The other problem is if we don't pay for this now and enforce our housing code now, we're going to pay again and again for the rehab of this housing. I commend Commissioner Leonard's work because much of the housing that we acquire to preserve as subsidized housing or to keep it low income, we spend tremendous money rehabbing it. And if we keep private housing in good condition now, if we acquire it, if we subsidize it, we'll reduce those costs. I also think that we need to look at enforcement against the other things that we're funding, such as tax credits, tax exemptions, make sure that those are kept in good condition so they aren't coming back again and again for the subsidies. I think I wanted to address a couple things. You mentioned changes in state law, and I think there may be some structural requirements that we can make in a building code that require some more ventilation issues. I also want to support the tenant about the risk to the tenant of complaints and that we have to figure out a way around a complaint, strictly complaint-driven system. Thank you.
Mayor and commissioners, thanks for the opportunity to talk today. I'm going to keep my comments short because Andrea mentioned our report that we did in 2005 and mentioned some of the findings. Just really briefly, the key findings were that people did believe
State
that.
Your name for the record,
I'm sorry,
please.
Ian Slingerland, and I'm providing testimony on behalf of the Community Alliance of Tenants. The folks we spoke to believed, half the folks we spoke to who called us about repair problems believed that their housing conditions were making them sick. And they believed that there were inadequate tools in place to allow them to secure improved conditions. The lack of affordable housing combined with the threat of no-cause evictions and retaliation really limit the options available to tenants trying to secure new housing. We've been really encouraged by the substantial work that has taken place at the Neighborhood Inspections Team over the last year to improve strategies within the constraints of existing code. But meaningfully addressing the problem of substandard housing will require significant changes to the status quo, changes that will take further action by this council. We recognize that the majority of landlords in our city treat their responsibilities with diligence and care. Unfortunately, our experience and the existing data suggests that a significant minority do not. The impact is devastating and borne by the most vulnerable people in our city. We look forward to the city improving its systems and tools for holding landlords accountable in those instances where they're willfully failing to meet their responsibilities. At the same time, we believe more can be done to provide appropriate tools and resources to support landlords working in good faith to provide safe homes for their tenants. This council has shown its willingness to break new ground when necessary, and it is much appreciated. We look forward to your continuing engagement on this issue and look forward to coming back to you with recommendations that you can take action on. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jonathan Traus. I do a weekly volunteer shift for the Community Alliance of Tenants Renters Rights Hotline. I first became involved with them following a repair issue I had at an apartment I lived on Southeast Salmon Street. In October of 2005, the hot water heater developed a leak. The owner came over and performed what was essentially a duct tape and bubble gum repair job. And over the course of the next 3 months, unbeknownst to me and my wife, the water heater continued to leak slowly until eventually part of the flooring gave way and water flooded into the complex's shared basement that runs beneath the unit. The owner replaced the hot water heater and fixed the segment of flooring, but the damage caused by 3 months of leakage was greater. Black mold visible in the ceiling of the basement and the exact pattern of the water stain formed under our living room floor. The smell was nauseating. My wife and I experienced headaches and respiratory problems. When we called our landlord about this, he told us that, quote, mold has no smell, and the mold you see is in the basement ceiling, not your apartment flooring, even though they're essentially one and the same. We did eventually move. However, before doing so, I came across Katz Renters Rights Hotline in the phone book. They provided me with information about reduced rental value and gave us information for the neighborhood inspection program. We opted to move before using the program, however, because had we used it, our landlord would only have had to paint over the mold to fix the violation. Since then, I have volunteered weekly for CAT, returning calls to the same hotline that helped me out. I've heard many stories that make my own pale in comparison. At least once a month, and oftentimes more, I hear a variation of the phrase, I don't want to complain too much because the last few tenants that did so have all been evicted. This is often in regards to basic essential service repairs, such as plumbing and heating. In many cases, I do refer people to the inspection program. However, it can often prove difficult to convince low-income renters to utilize the service, knowing that if they complain, their landlord will find out, or they can't afford moving costs, such as security deposits and van rental fees, if the inspectors declare their building uninhabitable. I do applaud your efforts. By forming a work group, you have taken the necessary first step towards achieving a viable solution, but simply exploring options is not enough. You must take action. Otherwise, as housing prices continue to skyrocket in the city of Portland, many more people will find themselves without reasonably priced, well-maintained places to live. Thank you.
Our last three are Aaron McNally, Rachel Langford, and Teresa Teeter.
Thanks for being here. When you speak, state your name for the record. You each have 2 minutes.
My name's Teresa Teeter. I live in Oregon City, but my landlord lives somewhere in Portland, Oregon. I don't know where. I'm a Shelter Plus Care recipient from the McGinney Grant from Washington, D.C., and I maintain the property at our building because nobody ever shows up. I write. I complain. I've got mold on my bathroom window. I've got a heater that doesn't work in my bedroom. I have stripped the bed paint and the green mold off the stair railing to the laundry room outside the building and repainted it myself. I have trimmed the hedges on the property. I was informed January 10th in my kitchen by my owner when the management switched to new people that no, he wasn't going to thank me for shoveling the snow off the front sidewalks around the property and that it was the responsibility of the tenants and he wouldn't thank me, et cetera, et cetera. Clackamas County Housing Authority pays a portion of my rent to this bozo and I pay $250 of my Social Security disability to this bozo. We have water running across our laundry room floor. I turn the water off down there. The coin slots are jammed up on the washing machine that you have to take a hammer and a crowbar to get your money in and get the slot back out so you can wash the next load. And the dryers smell like they're burning because it runs for an hour and a half, so you can get 3 loads of laundry washed and dried off one dryer as long as the building doesn't burn down. I hope to God it never does. I always wonder when I come back from these council meetings if the building's still going to be there. We've had chronic nuisance problems. We got a man downstairs with 4 cars that the owner said it was okay to have. Looks like we got drug traffic running in and out of the building at his apartment constantly. I found giant hypodermic needles this big with barbs on them and said biological specimens on them in UPS boxes in the garbage. I got the Oregon City Police to come get those. I don't know if they're doing anything about it. I call city codes constantly. I leave doors unlocked for them to go in and look at things, and nobody responds to me. And this man's getting tax money in your town and spending it on other properties or something. And I am furious, and I can't get answers. And this should not be happening to me. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Erin McNally, and I'm with the Josiah Hill Clinic. Many of you know our organization. We provide education, testing, and resources to families, specifically families with young children that are at risk for environmental health hazards. We work with a lot of immigrant refugee communities, communities of color, and low-income residents here in Portland. And we're very aware of the detrimental effects, especially on young children that are absorbing environmental toxins in their environment, such as housing, lead, the mold and mildew, and that, as you had mentioned, Mayor Potter, can affect their ability to go to school, and as for the parents, their ability to go to work. And so it has a very large impact on our city. So I certainly thank everybody for the putting together this work group. I think that it'll allow us an opportunity to really see what we can do to break down some of the barriers that do exist that might be language barriers, cultural barriers, and also swift repair barriers that some of our families that we work with encounter on a day-to-day basis. And certainly believe that it's also a justice issue, that every family here in Portland really deserves an equal opportunity to live in safe and healthy housing so that we can flourish. And I thank you very much for looking into the opportunity for us to make that happen as a community here in the city of Portland. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Rachel Langford, and 2 years ago I was coordinating the clean air programs of the American Lung Association of Oregon. And one of our most thriving programs was called the Master Home Environmentalist that was providing a really needed service, as you can hear, as we've been discussing today. It was one of the few programs that did outreach to families who were having problems with indoor air quality and believed it was impacting their health. And a large majority of the calls that we received were from renters who believed that there was something in their home making them sick. And the program was really unique in that we tooled up volunteers with 45 hours of training from experts in the field to go out and address these concerns. And the crux of the program was to give the families free and inexpensive fixes to those problems. And so some of that behavioral stuff that we've been talking about today to prevent things like mold and indoor air quality problems. And me and my volunteers were continually frustrated as we went out into the field and realized, you know, they'd spend 2 hours in an apartment doing an assessment and realize the tools that should be available to these families to deal with their indoor air quality problems were not available, and that many families were scared to take the steps to get that bathroom fan fixed or get their heat at a level that would not, you know, either not allow mold to grow. I mean, either too cold or too hot is an ideal environment for mold. And this just made us really understand, or made us at the Lung Association really understand, that substandard housing is an environmental health issue. And it was kind of a stretch for the Lung Association to get involved in substandard housing issues, but we realized the link was so clear with kids missing school and asthma on the rise that we just had to get involved. And so even though I'm no longer in that job, I'm very pleased to be here today thanking you for taking the first step towards dealing with this issue, and I really encourage you to act upon the recommendations of this work group. Thanks so much.
Does the Lung Association still offer that program, the Master?
Master Home Environmentalist. They do not in Oregon. The funding was cut, so it's no longer available, unfortunately. And I don't know that there's another program out there that meets the need.
Thank you.
We are providing the services in the Coley neighborhood, but look forward to expanding to help meet those needs. Yeah.
Through the Josiah Hill?
Yeah, through the Josiah Hill Clinic. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to let you know, too, I've developed asthma from the time that I've lived in this building where I'm talking that this man makes his money in Portland. And I've cleaned up cat excrement day in and day out from neighborhood cats using the bark dust. I don't know where your system
could help
me here.
Teresa, you've had your 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Just wanted to know. Small children live there, too.
Thank you. Is that the...
That's all who signed up.
Okay. There's no council action required, correct?
It's a report, I think, so
We have it listed as a presentation.
We'll accept the report.
Okay, I guess we don't have to accept it.
I can change it to a report. It's not.
Oh, that's fine.
And moved and seconded.
Okay, you want to do a roll call?
Take the roll.
Adams?
Important stuff. Thank you, Commissioner Sten and Leonard. And everyone else involved. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Good work. I look forward to the results of this work group, and I hope they're tangible and meaningful. Aye.
Sten?
Aye. Good job.
Potter.
I think this is important work. Right along with finding affordable housing, we also have to make sure the houses that are occupied by low-income families do meet certain standards for protection and safety. I vote aye. We're going to move to the three emergency ordinances. Please read item 410.
410, amend contract with Architectural Resources Group to provide additional architectural and engineering services for Union Station Transportation Enhancement. Oh, I'm sorry, 410. Create a new non-represented classification of police internal affairs investigator and establish a compensation rate for this classification.
Staff?
I've had my questions answered. If I don't need a lot of information.
You folks.
David Reese, Bureau of Human Resources, here to answer any questions about the classification. With me is Chief Sizer.
Any questions for the BHR or the chief? Thank you. It's emergency vote. Is there a sign-up sheet testimony?
I did not set out one. We had the first reading last week.
Okay. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Stanton?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 413.
Authorize agreement with Gemuter Engineering, LLC, for annual inspection services for the Portland aerial tram.
Staff?
It's important we inspect the tram, and this allows us to do that.